This is Science Friday. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, filling in for Ira Flatow. After decades of polling, scientists have a pretty good handle on what Americans think about climate change. 63% of adults believe it is happening. 52% say they're worried about it. But what does the rest of the world think? Scientists have been crunching the numbers from a Gallup poll of 119 countries, and this week they report their findings in the journal Nature Climate Change. Anthony Leiserwitz is the director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication and an author of that study, and he joins me now to talk about it. Welcome, Anthony.
Hi, Manoush. Great to be with you.
Okay, so how much of the world has not gotten the message about climate change?
Yeah. So what we find that globally, about 4 out of 10 adults worldwide has never heard of climate change. And that number actually rises to as much as 65% or more in particular developing countries such as Egypt or India or even Bangladesh, which is often seen as a poster child of climate change impacts. So it basically indicates that there's still a very large number of people, roughly about 2 billion worldwide, who've never heard of climate change.
Now, just to be clear, this data is from 2007 and 2008. Do we assume that the situation has improved at all since then, or explain to me how you take that into account?
Yeah. So basically, one of the primary ways that people learn about climate change, of course, is through media coverage. And so one thing that we are able to see through our colleagues who study this is that media coverage reached its all-time high in 2007, 2008, exactly when this survey was taken. But then it really dropped dramatically after 2008, and it still hasn't made it back up to the period or to the same levels that it was in 2007. So I would be surprised, certainly at the global scale, that we would see major changes in these numbers.
So why is this message not getting out? Can we assume that it's because of lack of education? What are some of the reasons?
Well, so like I just said, media coverage is really important because, again, this is an issue that for most people is invisible. You can look out the window right now. There's CO2 coming out of cars and out of tailpipes and out of buildings and smokestacks. It's coming out of your mouth and nose this very second. But unless you, until I said it, you weren't conscious of it.
Yeah.
It's invisible to most of us. So media coverage is really important. But what we identify very importantly in this study is it's also driven, especially in developing countries, by lack of education. And it makes sense. If you're illiterate, it's very difficult to participate in global conversations about a topic that is usually couched in the terms of science and politics.
And is there something different about specific countries in terms of what determines whether or not someone sees climate change as a risk?
It is, and that's what's also very interesting, is that it depends on where you look. So in the developed world, generally speaking, knowing that climate change is mostly caused by humans is a really important predictor of then perceiving it as a risk. But in many developing countries, especially Africa and Asia, it's actual personal experience with weather. And that's a really important factor. And we know this from lots of other studies, that while many people have never heard of climate change before, they are seeing changes in their local environments, changes in temperature, changing rainfall patterns. And they're highly attuned to this because many, of course, billions of people around the world are still essentially subsistence farmers. They depend on weather conditions for their basic survival. So it actually doesn't take a whole lot to convince them that climate change is real. It's just they've never been engaged with the issue, even at that basic awareness level.
Okay, so with the information that you've got, what do we do next? What do we do with this data?
Well, one of the things I think it does is actually it informs the nations who are gathering in Paris later this year around further negotiations for a global treaty. One of the things they committed to actually years ago was to inform and educate and engage their populations about this issue. And I think what this evidence shows us is that there's still a lot of work to be done. And it's critical because each of these countries, from the individual level to the community, the city, the state, all the way up to the national level, are constantly making really important decisions about the future. What crops do we plant? Where do we build our new cities? Where do we site our hospitals and roads and schools? And if you don't have the concept of climate change in mind, you're probably making decisions that are going to put you at greater risk. In fact, I would say, if you don't know you're at risk, you are at greater risk.
Anthony Leiserwitz is director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication. Anthony, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Manoush.
Knowing that climate change really is happening is one thing, but what about that next step? How do you make the leap from climate change awareness to action? Well, this week, we heard about an experiment happening right now out in Marin County, California. It's designed to help Marin residents see their climate change future and start planning for it. And bringing us the story is KQED science reporter Daniel Potter. Welcome to Science Friday, Daniel.
Really glad to be here.
Okay, explain the project. I love this one.
So imagine you're walking down a scenic bike path near the water a few miles north of the Golden Gate Bridge in Marin County, and you come across something that looks kind of like, imagine the old-timey viewfinders, like binoculars that you would pop a quarter into when you're at the park. It's sort of like that, except what it's showing you when you put your eyes up to it is a kind of augmented reality of what the space around you would look like under different scenarios, underwater, under sea level rise.
Okay, I'm dying to know about those scenarios. I looked at one of the pictures online, but did you actually go and try out one of these viewers?
I did. The first scenario it shows, interestingly, actually already happened last December.
Oh.
This big storm came through. Yeah, this big storm came through at exactly the same time as a really big high, what they call a king tide. And so you see where the road was flooded out at the time, which left some people stranded. At least one guy was seen paddleboarding to work at the time. So then from there, the machine sort of walks you through, okay, if sea level rise long-term puts this place underwater, how can we deal with it? And so it shows you options like, if we put a concrete flood wall, here's what that would look like. There's one where grass is sort of rising out of the water where they would build an earthen berm. And throughout, the machine is asking you, what are you interested in terms of these different kinds of remedies?
And who is it that wants people to see what things could look like? Who's behind this?
So this installation?
These? Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just wondering.
Yeah. The installation itself was actually funded by FEMA. I've heard people say that today's flood could be tomorrow's high tide. County officials in Marin are also really keyed into this. Someone I talked to there said they're thinking really hard about these types of projects like flood walls and the like because they're sort of having to weigh them against the cost of doing nothing long term. The company that actually makes the viewers is based here in Bay Area. They're called Owl Eyes. They have a foundry in East Bay. And then rounding it out is a group called Climate Access.
And what do they think is going to happen with this approach? I mean, it would be really cool to look at, but then what's the actual knock-on effect?
The idea is showing these scenarios to people who are physically standing there. Oftentimes, I think climate change can feel remote or hypothetical. And so the thought is maybe showing it to people as they're standing there will make it feel more concrete, maybe resonate with people in a more meaningful way. It's sort of an experiment to see if that works. So I put the same question to a social scientist named Suzanne Moser, who looks at the connection between climate change and social change. She told me our brains are wired to react to immediate threats. We're less good at wrapping our minds around long-term risk, and that's climate change. Here's what Suzanne Moser said on that.
Risk is something that we react to. You know, if you see a car coming at you, you jump outside the road. What's been difficult is to motivate people with a very large, very abstract thing they cannot imagine. And so one of the ways in which we can at least make the risk more real to people is to convey it in ways that are unequivocal. They're very clear to imagine. And visualization in the places where that risk will unfold does that.
Is she right, Daniel? You were there. You went out to look through the viewfinders. Were other people out there using them too?
Yeah, they were. Someone from Owl Eyes told me since they flipped the on switch around early June, 2,500 people have at least hit push to start on these viewfinders. Something like a third of them are under 15, and at least 60 have stayed long enough to leave audio feedback and sort of free associate about what they just saw there in the park. The day I was there, a family actually stopped by, including this high schooler named Connor Barr. He said his own house is flooded, and climate change is something he thinks about a lot. They talk about it in school. This was interesting to me. Marin is sort of an affluent, privileged place, and he thinks because of that, this type of pilot effort could become a model for other places with similar concerns. Here's what Connor had to say about that.
One of the benefits we have about living in such a beautiful and nice area that has enough money to like actually think about these things head on is that we can sort of be the ambassadors for change, at least in America. So it's definitely we need to take that with stride and sort of be the first to implement these changes in our community.
What a lovely, thoughtful teenage young man. I mean, that's...
Indeed.
Yeah, I mean, and what about him? Is he right? What does Marin hope to get out of this? Are they potentially a role model for other cities doing this? Is it worth it?
For them, in answering that question, one of the next signposts that they're watching for, they're planning a big town hall meeting toward fall, and so they're hoping to get lots of turnout, I think in part because of this project with the viewfinders in the park. They're also hoping, in showing these different scenarios, flood walls and berms and so on, that they can maybe start getting public input and hopefully coalesce around more concrete plans. I've been told that doing that, having those types of plans, makes it easier to get federal money to help build projects like that if they're already planned and already have that kind of local buy-in. The other dimension of this that I think Connor spoke to is scaling it up. If it succeeds here, would other places want to try to adopt similar projects, which is something that company Owlized is definitely betting on? And I think, as Connor said, a lot of other people hope this could be exactly that type of model as well.
As far as you know, Daniel, are there other plans to put these in other towns? Are there? I mean, I would love to see them here in New York. I can just imagine looking out across New York Harbor and reminiscing about Sandy, Hurricane Sandy.
You know, when I talked to the founder of Owlized about that, he mentioned now they have a foundry in San Leandro in the East Bay here. So they're definitely making an investment, I think, in hopes of scaling up exactly this type of technology and deploying it more broadly than just Marin.
Daniel, thank you so much for checking out this project for us.
Thank you. It's been a delight.
Daniel Potter is a science reporter at KQED in San Francisco. Coming up, wearable technology. It actually goes way back. We'll talk about a few of the devices that never made the big time and what you might be wearing on your face, on your body. Stay with us to find out. This is Science Friday. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, sitting in for Ira Flatow. Okay, this next story speaks right to my heart. We have all been there. You're strolling down the street, you're the sidewalk, but your eyes, they're not fixed on where you're going. Oh no, you're staring at your phone. If you, like me, have had this experience, you probably know it isn't the fastest or most direct way to get to your destination. You're weaving, you're shuffling, maybe pulling over occasionally when you want to be polite, but all the time you're answering phone calls or entering that crazy alphanumeric password into an app. And now science has decided to take a look at this behavior, this annoying behavior, to see if walking and texting, or wexting, as I like to call it, if it's a danger to your safety, like we know driving and texting is. Conrad Ernest is a research scientist at Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas, and he and his colleague conducted that study out in the journal PLOS ONE this week. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Ernest.
Hi, Manoush. It's nice to be here.
Hi there. Okay. Dr. Ernest, I have to say, I was walking down the sidewalk and I saw two people who were wexting bang into each other, smack into each other. Do you walk and text?
Yes, but not a lot.
So tell us about your experimental setup here and why you decided to study this.
Well, I think more and more in the past few years, I've been acutely aware of the idea that we spend too much time looking at our phones and not enough time looking around. And I remember at the time I was a professor in the Department of Health at the University of Bath in England, and I was in a coffee shop one Saturday morning. Bath being a heritage city, there's lots of stag and hen parties, or what we would call bachelor and bachelorette parties. People come to shop, all that sort of thing. And I came out of the coffee shop and the street was packed, and I just got really annoyed walking behind people who were texting and kind of weaving about, and I didn't watch anybody run into each other, but it just got really annoying. And then we were rolling into the next term of school there, and I knew that a bunch of students wouldn't be needing dissertation projects, because everybody at the undergraduate level does a dissertation project. So I proposed that, and two students, Robin Smith and Sammy License, jumped on it, did a fantastic job. And generally what we did is the students, we met, we designed, we discussed, and then the students went off into the city and measured things like curbs and ramp heights and step heights. And Bath, being a heritage city, has sometimes irregular steps, so they came up with irregular steps, and they went and borrowed from the rugby team these sort of model men so we could sort of emulate real people, designed a really lovely obstacle course with the help of Dr. Polly McGuigan, who's a biomechanist, did an analysis of their gait characteristics, why they were texting and why they were texting and entertaining math questions simultaneously as a means of distraction.
And how did the volunteers do on the test? I mean, I would have assumed that they were tripping all over the place, that they're while they're texting and doing math equations, right?
Yeah, so what we basically found is that people who were texting and doing what we called a cognitive distraction test, they deviated from their pathway a little bit. They kind of move right and left, not too dissimilar to what people do when they're walking down the street. But the most interesting characteristics is that we actually, through the biomechanical setup, we had contact points on all the barriers. And that if somebody touched a barrier with their foot, we would assume that that would be a tripping behavior or put them at risk for tripping. We didn't see any increase in the actual barrier context. What we did notice that people basically just slowed down, and what we think is they just took on a more cautious walking pattern relative to what they were doing.
So what you're saying is that walking and texting, while it might be annoying to those of us around us, it is not actually dangerous.
No, I wouldn't say that. I think, you know, science is one of those things that you approach in a very exacting manner. You try and build experiments and design experiments that don't have a lot of bias or variance mixed into them. And so I think, you know, the strength of our studies that we used a very strong study design. It was very consistent. The bias or the error in our study is that when people walked in the door, they knew they were going to walk on an obstacle course. So I think they subconsciously sort of ingrained or put into their head to take perhaps a more cautious approach. So I don't think in a perfect world we'd like to be able to transfer information from the lab to the street. But if you look at general statistics, you'll see that teen-related traffic pedestrian injuries are increasing continually. And there's a big tie with as much as 40 to 50% of those being related to listening to music or to texting or what we riskier crossing behaviors when they're near a street due to what's called inattentional blindness. They're looking at their cell phone. They're not paying attention to what's going around them.
All right. Conrad Ernest is a research scientist at Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas. Conrad, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, and thanks for having me.
We've been talking about the evils of head down mode, staring at your phone, and how your devices can pull you out of your world, away from eye contact and human interactions. But that's precisely the problem that wearable technology is supposed to solve, right? A signature tap on the wrist? Oh, it must be mom. Or directions up in the corner of your glasses so you can look straight ahead as you walk. Well, one of my next guests had that mission in mind when he built his own smart glasses over 20 years ago. It was a pair of safety goggles with a mini display glued to one side, all hooked up to a wireless modem and a tiny keyboard that he called the Twiddler. That and other objects from the evolutionary history of wearables are on display now at the Computer History Museum in Silicon Valley. You can see how far we've come for yourself. We've got a link to the online exhibition at sciencefriday.com/wearables. And joining me now is Thad Starner, a professor of computing at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. He also worked on Google's Glass project. Welcome to Science Friday, Thad.
Thank you for having me.
And if you've always thought that wearables just aren't fashionable enough and could never be part of your look, well, my other guest may change your mind. Amanda Parks is a fashion technologist and chief of technology and research at Manufacture New York in Brooklyn. And she's here with me now in our New York studios. Welcome, Amanda.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
If you have got a wearable, listeners, that you would like to see happen, give us a call at 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK, or you can tweet us at SciFry. Okay, Thad, let's start with you. This idea of glasses with a little video screen, which most of us probably only heard about when we saw Google Glass for the first time, this was something that you had been working on and actually wearing since the 1990s. Your prototypes are in the exhibit. Can you tell me what was the inspiration for that?
Well, for me, it was about being a better student. I was paying a lot of money to MIT every year to take classes, but I found I forgot most of them. I couldn't take good notes and pay attention to the blackboard at the same time. But by having a head-up display, I could put the focus of the display at the same depth as the blackboard and see what the professor, see my notes and listen to the professor at the same time and type with this little one-handed keyboard called a Twiddler, and allow me to take notes quickly enough that I could actually both pay attention to the lecture, understand it, and get book quality format notes for it. But the big thing for me was I found out that most of my education was coming from face-to-face conversations. It wasn't the classroom that was telling me what I needed to know. It was sitting across from a Nobel Prize winner over lunch and discussing his science. And I was just as effective with this one-hand keyboard and this head-up display taking notes on that conversation as I was in classroom.
So have you been wearing wearables ever since then? Are you wearing anything on you right now? I feel very odd asking you that question without being able to see you.
I'm wearing glass right now, in fact.
You are wearing glass right now. What about you, Amanda? What have you got on? Got any wearables going on there?
I'm just wearing Ringly, which is the only wearable I wear every day, which is a notification ring. But mostly it's first a fat piece of fashion, a beautiful ring that you don't know is actually a piece of technology.
I mean, and listeners, it's a gold ring with like a large rectangle of, it looks like cloudy quartz.
It's moonstone, and it's real metals, real gold, real semi-precious stones.
But so, what does it do?
So basically it ties to an app in your phone, and it can notify you either via vibration or a tiny LED covered in a diamond on the side, which you can change the color of through your app. So you can change the vibration patterns and the colors.
So Amanda, where does the history of wearables begin for you? How far back does it go that far back?
Well, yeah, I actually think it goes back a little bit further. And I like to think of, you know, technology is a language of functionality. And I really appreciate what that is talking about that added functionality of what these devices can do for you. But fashion is a language of personal expression and identity. And I like to think back to sort of something like when Giacomo Balla, an Italian futurist designer, made a tie with a light bulb. This is in 1919, yeah, with a battery and a light bulb inserted, and he would flash it on and off to sort of engage the public during as a form of expression during his speeches.
Kind of like a human firefly.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, this whole idea of, you know, sort of wanting to express, you know, emotion and wanting to think about identity and desire in terms of wearables, to me, is something that hasn't quite been tapped into as much as we can. And
now, Thad, in the 1950s, there was actually a wearable that a guy developed to improve his odds at roulette. Can you tell that story, please?
Certainly. His name was Edward Thorpe. He wrote a very famous book called How to Beat the Dealer on how to count cards at blackjack. It's still sold in Las Vegas gambling casinos today. But his first project was actually trying to make a wearable computer to predict which octant a ball would fall in roulette. And he and Claude Shannon, who's very famous for information theory, and it's where the term baud rate came from, put together a system and actually used it at blackjack, at roulette in Las Vegas in 1961, a fully functional system. And it did work. It gave them about a 44% advantage over house.
And how?
In roulette in Las Vegas, you spin the wheel and you spin the ball, and people are allowed to place bets until the ball falls below a certain line. And so what Shannon would do is he'd sit there and watch the ball and time it with taps with his big toe and his foot.
Huh.
And he'd do the same thing with the rotor. The system would then solve a set of equations and predict the outcome, send that wirelessly to Ed Thorpe, who had something that looked like a hearing aid that he was wearing. It would chime in his ear, and then he could place the bets appropriately.
It's amazing. Okay, so Amanda, here we are, 50, 60 years later, and you actually invented a dress that parasitically harvests energy from a person when she walks. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things that I'm interested in is sort of thinking about wearables being all across the surface of the body. In order to do that, we need to be moving more into fiber science and into textiles. So I've been looking at new paradigms of how we can integrate the functionality of circuits into our fibers. And this is, you know, something that's going on across wearable technology development in smart fabrics.
So you don't even know that it is a wearable.
Exactly. Part of it is to make it completely kind of transparent and invisible. So looking at the body as an energy system, there's lots of ways in which we generate energy through our mechanical motion, through heat, et cetera. And so there's different ways we can actually harness this. One way is through piezoelectrics. Now, a lot of this isn't actually up to the level where, you know, it charges quickly enough for it to be super functional. But from a concept pieces, we can start to push this forward. And as the sort of technology gets better and we can integrate it more fully in a nanotech way into the fibers themselves, we have greater volume. And then we really can start to think about sort of harnessing energy across the entire surface of the body.
So I could charge my phone by putting it in my pocket, maybe?
Yes,
eventually?
If you're in this situation, if you're walking. But also there's other things like the fiber battery technologies that someone like Dan Steingart at Princeton is developing. You know, that is really a battery that's actually completely woven into your garment so that, you know, the literal fibers of your garment are the battery, which is really exciting to me.
I'm Anoush Samarodi, sitting in for Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Thad, you know, how do you make technology disappear? You're talking about putting it on your face, but is there a way to make it so that people forget they're even wearing a device? I mean, that's the goal eventually, right?
Well, the most powerful technologies are those that disappear. But it doesn't have to disappear physically. It can just disappear into how people use it. For example, people wear eyeglasses all the time. I'm looking through a pair of eyeglasses right now. But we don't really think about that technology at all. I just use it as an extension of myself. And what we're going to see in the near future, I think, is more and more technology where you wear it as part of your daily life. And it's just part of how you see things. It's like when you ride a bicycle. You know, if somebody pulls in front of you and you need to stop, you don't think about the complex mechanism for braking. You just stop. The bicycle is an extension of yourself. We're going to have the same sort of thing in the future where we start using these machines by instinct, and we call it instinctual computing. And, you know, that's the same as using eyeglasses or using a watch. You know, if you've now relegated time to your watch, so if I want to see if I'm going to be late for my next appointment, I just glance down and say I'm still okay, and I go on to what I'm doing. I don't even really comprehend what time it is. It's just that, you know, the little hand is still not at 12. But what we've been seeing at Georgia Tech now is that there's other ways of making this instinctual computing. For example, we have a pair of gloves that you put on that will teach you how to play piano without your conscious attention. So in the amount of time it takes your listeners to hear this segment, they might have learned the first 30 notes to Amazing Grace or Turkey's March. And how this works is you download the song you want to learn into your cell phone, and it then plays the song, and as each note is played, it taps the finger that belongs to that note. And so after about 30 minutes of exposure to this, you walk up to the piano and figure out where the first note is, and then your hand just knows what to do magically. It's teaching you the muscle memory of the song without you paying attention to it. And so I think we're going to get more and more devices where we can actually make wearable computers that basically we are using by instinct.
But I just want to follow up. You were talking about how technology can disappear, but you were one of the developers of Google Glass, and that was something that the public just did not embrace. They couldn't get over the fact. They couldn't have it disappear on people's faces. It was too intrusive. Was that a disappointment?
Well, one of the things that's amazing about Google Glass and this whole new generation of wearables is the fact that people were willing to put it on in the first place. So I've been wearing a machine as part of my daily life since 1993. And at my first class each semester, I have to explain why I have the computer on. I have notes on my lecture. It helps me look at the clock and know my timing. It really helps me give a better lecture. And so I explain that to the students. I explain to them how I use my wearable computer in my daily life for navigation, book reading, writing papers, all this sort of stuff. And at the end of class, I put down on the table and say, okay, who wants to try out my system? And about 50% of people would raise their hands. And this is a tech school, one of the best in the world, and you have people studying things like ubiquitous computing and AI, and only 50% of them want to try it on. And that's because, you know, it really looked, it was this big thing. But then the first year I came in with Glass, 2012, I came in and said, you know, here's my wearable computer, here's how I use it. How many people would like to try this? 99% of people raised their hands. And so it doesn't matter how good the technology is, until people are willing to at least try it on, it won't mean anything. But once people see enough functionality in it after they've tried it on, it just becomes part of our normal expression. Cell phones have become part of our normal day, and same with eyeglasses, same with rings, watches, etc.
Okay, we have to take a very quick break. We're going to talk more about technology and the body when we come back. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, sitting in for Ira Flatow. We're talking about wearable technology this hour with my guests, Amanda Parks, a fashion technologist and chief of technology and research at Manufacture New York in Brooklyn, and Thad Starner, a professor of computing at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Amanda, let's get into the fashion side of this. One of the things that you do, if I understand it correctly, you're the CTO of a company that's actually looking at changing how the high heel works. Is that right? Is that considered wearable technology?
Yes, I actually think so. And I think that there's a lot of sort of untapped areas and opportunities in that space. So not all fashion technology has to necessarily involve electronics and circuits, but we can think of the convergence between electronics and material science in particular ways. And the high heel is a very interesting and personal problem that I think is ripe for research. And Thesis Couture has taken this on, redesigning the stiletto from the inside out. The CEO, Dolly Singh, is a former SpaceX employee, and she gathered up a team of, you know, basically a rocket scientist, an astronaut.
Because that's how hard it is to get high heel that's comfortable. It's
absolutely
as hard as getting to space.
It is a dynamic structural engineering problem that's actually complex, making little bridges under your feet that, you know, support the loading of a woman in motion. It's actually a very complex engineering problem. And we have a team that's a true hybrid. We've also got an orthopedic surgeon. We've got me. We've got, you know, the former creative director Jimmy Choo. This is very high fashion and very high tech. And, you know, we start by designing in SolidWorks and in engineering and then move towards, you know, IP around new ballistic polymers. And then to create these shoes, which really can act like, you know, a rocket ship or a very high-end bridge.
Right. I want to try a prototype. Let's take a call. Let's go to Hayden in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Hayden. You're on Science Friday.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I have two questions for you guys today. The first being, now that wearables are being brought more into the public eye, what is the end goal for wearable designers? Is it for there to be multiple wearable devices a person to wear, each serving a specific purpose, or is there hope for one piece of wearable that will kind of take care of all the redundancies and notifications that eventually everyone will have this one piece of technology? And also, this is more of a childhood spy fantasy, but what's the feasibility of a contact lens being an idea for a wearable one day?
Great questions. Thanks so much, Hayden. Thad, what do you think about that? Is there a possibility that there's one fits all sort of mechanism or device that takes care of everything, or is it sort of either body part or purpose specific for wearables?
Well, I think we're going to have a very big set of devices people can choose from. We'll have one device that is in the pocket that connects you to the cellular network and has some storage and computing on it. But then people will choose the peripherals they want for that day, for that task. You might choose earbuds if you just want to listen to music, or a head-up display if you want to actually get notifications or navigation information. Or you might have a medical monitoring device for, you know, checking your diabetes. But what we're going to see is sort of this body network, which these devices are going to hook into, much the same we had with the PC. The PC had the ISA bus, and then people would put different peripherals into that depending on what they wanted to do. We'll have the same sort of thing on the body.
And do you agree with that, Amanda?
Yes, I do. But I also think that we need to think about different markets. So where is the wearable for an elderly, you know, elegant woman trying to track her health? That, you know, my mother's not going to wear a plastic fitness bracelet. So I think if we also think about diversity of, you know, design, diversity of functionality based on who we're trying to sell to, and also products that are more legacy products that, you know, won't be part of the kind of planned obsolescence model of technology, things that are meant to last through generations, like jewelry, like nice watches.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned scarves in some of the reading I did about your
work. So just kind of this, you know, expanding and extending who we're making for, why we're making it. And so it's not a one-size-fits-all. The Swiss Army knife has a place in this kind of model, but also very specialized high-end kitchen equipment does as well.
And this, to the second question, Thad, this idea of what was it? Contact lenses. That was the question.
Contact lenses.
Yeah. What's your answer to that one? I've heard of those, that the glucose monitoring contact lenses. Is that right?
Yes. That's one of the things that are out there. Whenever you have a new wearable computer you're trying to make, there's always four main points you're looking at. It's power, networking, mobile input, and display. And that's part of what we have in the ebook that we have on the Wearable Computing Center's website. I think you have a link to it. And what we show is how these different challenges have been overcome over the years, and it's particularly hard with a contact lens. Getting power to that lens is difficult. You generally use an infrared beam to beam power to it, or some inductive coupler and a pair of eyeglasses. So even though you have contact lenses on, if you're trying to do a contact lens display, you still get a pair of eyeglasses to put enough power to it. And then the problem is with the contact lens itself, it's very hard to make the optics so that those that any sort of display is in focus. Mm. And so you end up with something that might be, say, four characters or so with current technology is probably the limit of what you could expect anytime soon.
I want to take a call from Tracy in Cleveland, Ohio. I think she has something else she wants to ask about sight. Tracy, you're on Science Friday. Can you hear me?
I can.
Go ahead.
I am so excited. This is true synchronicity. I have so been waiting for this day. I am sight impaired, and I've always wondered why Google never remodified their glasses for blind people, because we're already out there tapping with the stick, and we want, like, all this stuff. We want to be able to go out and walk by ourselves and ride our bicycles by ourselves, and you guys are, like, coming up with all this new fantastic stuff that's perfect for this idea that I have been festering for years. And it's just, like, blowing my mind today. So if somebody could hook up with me, I would love to show and share my idea, because I think it's just going to set the world on fire.
Thank you so much, Tracy. So, guys, what do you think about that? Sight impaired? Amanda, you're sitting here nodding at me. What are you thinking?
Yeah, this is absolutely, this is a amazing opportunity, and I think there's lots of ideas inside of haptics. There's a very interesting pair of shoes just emerging into the market with haptic controls. But I'd love to talk to you. I'll get your information afterwards about
Tracy,
the idea, new ideas in the space.
Get your info. Go ahead, Thad. What do you think? I mean, this is something you definitely, with Google Glass, can speak to that.
Well, this is something that's been in the wearables community for a long, long time. In fact, one of the first wearable computers ever made in 1967 was by Hubert Upton to help people who were losing their hearing see the sounds they couldn't lip read. And so this idea of trying to make enabling devices for people has been as part of the community for a long, long time. And in particular, stuff for people with low vision or no vision has been part of the community. And you can look at things like OrCam coming out of Israel. You can look at a lot of these academic papers coming out of Spain using devices like glass to help people who have low vision. And even right now, if you tune into America's Got Talent, you'll find a 15-year-old dancer by name of Benjamin Yonatan, who is using glass to actually help him dance. But his impairment is he's lost all his peripheral vision. He has a very, very narrow tunnel vision. And he's currently, because glass has such a big 90-degree field of view with his camera, he basically turns on the camera and it allows him to see, to expand his visual field and be able to dance. We're seeing papers on people using these devices for hemispherical neglect, edge enhancement, all sorts of things. But, it's one of these things to try and make a sustainable business model and actually addressing people's concerns and trying to adapt these consumer technologies, which are now a whole lot cheaper and a whole lot more easy to obtain, to take these things that cost $1,000 instead of $5,000 or $50,000 and adapt them to people's individual needs.
Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. I want to talk about this more, but we have to go. Thad Starner, a professor of computing at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, Amanda Parks, fashion technologist and chief of technology and research at Manufacture New York in Brooklyn. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Next up, 2/3 of the marijuana consumed in this country comes from California, and a lot of it is grown on secret farms in the forests way up north of San Francisco in the so-called Emerald Triangle region. Business is booming. Wholesale pot sales in California are estimated to be anywhere between $11 and $16 billion. But with such a big crop, there's bound to be a few losers, right? My next guest and her colleagues say that cannabis farming is dishing out many of the same insults to the environment as the logging boom did in the 1900s. Clear cuts, road building, massive erosion, and native species that are already just hanging on for survival, like coho salmon and Pacific fishers, they are the ones who have to pay. Jennifer Cara is an ecologist in the water program at the Nature Conservancy in San Francisco. She's a co-author on a paper out in the journal Bioscience documenting the impacts of pot farming on the environment. And she joined us from KQED. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Jennifer, how bad is it when you go to some of these illegal grow sites? What do you see?
Well, the more we uncover, it's really turning out to be an environmental disaster. It's putting the health of California's land, water, and wildlife in jeopardy. I'll give you one example off the top here. One of the first things you might see at a marijuana farm in California is miles of irrigation tubing snaking across the landscape. And the water that's filling that tubing is by and large coming from sensitive streams and rivers that harbor rare and endangered species. You mentioned one, coho salmon, also steelhead trout. And these animals are already suffering due to drought conditions here. Water for marijuana cultivation is generally diverted in the summertime when streams in California are naturally at their lowest flow conditions. And research is showing that these diversions can completely dry up streams, killing these fish and other animals as well.
In your study, you have two satellite views of a region in the Emerald Triangle. One is in 2004, and then one is 8 years later in 2012. And already, it's full of holes in the forests and the roads and the clear cuts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, clear-cutting to make room for these farms is a big deal, converting native forests and fragmenting native forests. We see, you know, big open scars on the landscape from unpermitted grading to build greenhouses and gardens, road building, really extensive road building to service these gardens. All that grading and road building is bleeding dirt, eroding dirt into streams and rivers and smothering fish habitat.
I mean, makes me wonder, though, the poisons and the pesticides that they're using, if they travel downstream, does that mean that they get into human water supply as well then?
Yeah, they can. So there can be heavy use of herbicides, pesticides, and fertilizers in marijuana cultivation that certainly can pollute public waterways, and they also can poison wildlife.
So how do the growers get away with this? I mean, it seems like if you raised a big plot of forest and had this big operation going on that somebody would notice, no?
Yeah, you would think. In many ways, it's kind of like the Wild West or the Gold Rush all over again. There's so much money to be made here. You mentioned it earlier. It's, you know, up to a $16 billion in industry in California. That's more than dairy and almonds combined. There are people coming from all over the country and all over the world to grow marijuana in California. And we're seeing big increases in the acreage under production. Research is showing doubling in acreage in some parts of California since 2009. And the environmental impacts are just, not widely recognized, largely because it's being grown in the hidden corners of California where few people live, and also because there's very little regulation of the industry at this point.
I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. So, Jennifer Kara, can you talk more? You said it was more water than, did you say dairy and almonds combined that cannabis uses? Did I get that right?
No, the money, yeah.
The
so
money,
it's a 16,
sorry.
$16 billion industry, and that's more than almonds and dairy combined.
Gotcha. So are things any better in states with legal marijuana, like Washington and Colorado? Does legalizing help circumvent the illegal growing and environmental problems that you're talking about that are happening in Northern California?
Regulation of the industry is really kind of the key issue here. And when marijuana was legalized for recreational consumption in Washington, Colorado, they largely neglected the environmental impacts, and there were no revenues or resources that were provided to address those sorts of things. And we really, because California is the epicenter of marijuana cultivation in the U.S., we absolutely can't afford to make the same mistake. So as we're both thinking about how we're managing our existing medical markets and also considering future recreational markets in California, we absolutely need to have policies in place that protect the environment and provide sufficient resources to do three things. And that is regulate the industry like we do all other agriculture in the state, clean up the damage that's been done and get the chemicals out of the forests that are killing the wildlife. And third, restore hillsides and streams that have been damaged from grading and development.
I mean, have you ever heard of anyone who's actually stopped smoking pot from this area because they don't support the way that it's grown? Just like, I don't know, some people only buy organic food. It does sort of seem to be contradictory to the sort of, I guess, the marketing vibe that pot has, people being sort of environmentally friendly.
Yeah, I can't say that I have, but it is an interesting point. I mean, a lot of us think a lot about where we source all kinds of things, but I think there's kind of been a misperception in this industry. And, you know, like I said before, the environmental impacts are just not widely known at this point.
So what is your next step then, having done this research? How do you go about getting the word out?
Yeah, so we're trying to get the word out as much as we can by doing shows like this, publishing the paper, and interfacing with folks who are making decisions in California about the future of this industry. There's a number of bills going through the state legislature right now that are looking at regulating medical marijuana, and we're looking to try to influence that process and make sure that there are sufficient protections for the environment and resources as well.
Will state money help at all? Have you seen any of that?
So the state, for the first time last year, the governor allocated $3 million to help address this issue. But it's really, that's a drop in the bucket of what's actually needed. We estimate that to really comprehensively regulate the industry for environmental impacts and clean up and restore the damage that's been done, we need somewhere on the order of $120 million a year.
And I guess just finally, very quickly, to it's a little bit of a racy question to ask, but to the pot smokers out there, any advice on what to buy or not to buy? That's environmentally friendly?
I'm sorry. I'm afraid I don't.
Okay. All right. Just, maybe one day that will be the future of it, though, if we can do that. My guest has been Jennifer Cara, is an ecologist in the water program at the Nature Conservancy in San Francisco. Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And have you ever looked up at the sky and noticed what looks like waves breaking in the clouds? That repeating pattern is the result of a weird physics phenomenon, and we explain it in our picture of the week. You can see it at sciencefriday.com/clouds. You can email us. The address is scifry@sciencefriday.com, and you can find me, Manoush Samarodi, on my show. That's where I usually am. It's Note to Self. It's WNYC's tech podcast. We're at notetoselfradio.org. Ira Flato will be back next week. For now, in New York, I'm Manoush Samarodi. Thanks so much for having me, and enjoy your weekend.